May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Corey Holmes. The heightened protection of the right to counsel by the Delaware Constitution, along with the rationale underlying the decision in Martinez v. Ryan, requires a finding that Mr. Holmes is entitled to counsel on his first review collateral proceedings involving claims of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Can you give us, obviously in the very beginning, your understanding of the holding in Martinez?
Absolutely. In Martinez v. Ryan, the holding was very narrow, and it dealt with carving out an exception to procedural bars in federal habeas. And the exact holding is where ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims must be raised in an initial review collateral proceeding, a procedural default will not bar a federal habeas court from hearing those claims if the initial review collateral proceeding there was no counsel or counsel was ineffective.
Okay, so we're agreed this is not a federal constitutional principle that is to be applied for Martinez.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Or what they referred to as equitable.
That's right. That was what they characterized it as, but of course they did do an analysis underlying which was akin to a constitutional analysis.
But what you seek today is for us to examine the Delaware Constitution and convert it into a Delaware constitutional requirement that counsel be appointed for the indigent in the first stage of a Rule 61. Is that correct?
That's correct. As well as the fact, even adopting the equitable principles, I think as a practical effect, practical matter, that it would make sense, perhaps as the court's supervisory powers, to make it such that that's what the defendants are entitled to.
Is that an equitable ruling?
Yes.
If you go back to Martinez, before Martinez, everyone understood if there was an independent and adequate state grounds that was the basis for a decision, it would constitute a bar to further review. And one of the bars could be procedural. And what the United States Supreme Court held in Martinez is, as a matter of equity, we're not going to recognize a procedural bar if you didn't have counsel when you had your first opportunity to challenge the effectiveness of your trial counsel.
Right. That's correct. And I think one of the things where this could be illustrated in this particular case, why it would be helpful, is one could argue, well, he's raised his claim, so there's really no harm here, because he's protected all the procedural issues. However, we don't know if he's raised every possible substantial claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. And so if he tried to raise that at a later point, then the state would be facing a situation where they would be barred from making some procedural default holding.
And that the United States Supreme Court recognized that in Martinez when it said, if you don't have counsel when you're framing your ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, it's not going to be a very well articulated claim, that you really need an attorney to examine the effectiveness of your trial counsel.
That's exactly right, and that's what goes to the underlying constitutional rationale that they use, that they recognize that the investigative work and an understanding of trial strategy is necessary to support these ineffective assistance of counsel claims. In particular, when you're dealing with a situation where a trial strategy is central and the defendant is dealing with not only the defense attorney, who unfortunately on some occasions takes it personally and is motivated to justify their conduct, and you have the prosecutor who also knows trial strategy, and then you have a defendant who then has their claims characterized as speculative or theoretical, It's hard to imagine how they could master the trial strategy to come up with something more substantial.
Is there any room left for the trial judge to exercise discretion on review of the face of the petition under Rule 61 that there is inadequate assistance of counsel and simply say, on the face of it, this doesn't merit the appointment of counsel?
Well, currently there is, but what are you asking under Martinez, or are you?
I'm asking under your view of the current state of the law, is it still possible to, in effect, and don't read anything into this, but into effect, screen the frivolous before one tells the taxpayers to undergo the expense of a lawyer screening the frivolous and telling you that it's frivolous?
Yes, the way the law in Delaware is right now, that I would say that that is possible for this, the court to do. But when you look at...
But if we do that now after Martinez, what effect does that have on federal, I hate the word, but oversight?
What I think happens there is it doesn't protect the record. What the state claims, when there's state claims, that usually those findings are what drives the scope of the federal review. And so if there's no finding in the record there, it's harder for the federal courts to conduct a review as to what the state courts have found on the issues. And one of the things that they mention in Martinez is the fact that this initial review collateral proceedings is akin to a direct appeal. It's almost like one constitutional issue that can be used to attack a person's conviction has just been carved out. And so because it's been carved out and put into a context of being called a civil proceeding, the defendants aren't entitled to that right to counsel.
Well, what they said in a prior case, they built on it in Martinez, but what they said in a prior case is it's not really right to call this a collateral review, because if you can't raise it in your direct appeal and the first time you raise it is in your collateral appeal, that one issue is really a continuation of your direct attack.
That's correct.
But then the United States Supreme Court said, we're not going to address your right to counsel here, and then they also tried to avoid it again in Martinez. But they have recognized that this isn't strictly a collateral proceeding. It's a continuation of the direct proceeding if it's the first time you can attack the performance of trial counsel.
That's right. And in Martinez, they said that this was just like the Douglas versus California situation, which, in fact, the procedure that was used in California at the time was similar to what is being used for in these collateral proceedings for appointment of counsel. The judge or the appellate court would actually look at the record and decide whether it would be helpful to the defendant or helpful to the court if there was counsel. And the United States Supreme Court said, well, that's not equitable, because what happens is the defendant who can afford an attorney then has the benefit of an attorney going through the record and making arguments on their behalf, whereas one who can't afford an attorney gets a meaningless review, a meaningless ritual, in fact. And similarly here, the defendant who can't afford an attorney for collateral review is not getting the same type of representation that someone who is able to hire someone. And in Alaska, where they made a state constitutional finding, they used the similar conclusions that were used in Douglas. That is, look, these guys have a right to make this argument. They have a right to attack a conviction. All right, so they are allowed to make a claim, a constitutional claim, about their underlying conviction, and they can hire somebody. They have the right to hire somebody. So where does that leave the indigent? That leaves them without any right to address that particular constitutional claim.
And so that was under the Alaska Constitution, correct?
That's correct.
And if we adopt your position under the Delaware Constitution, you would necessarily have to depart from our precedent that says due process under the Delaware Constitution means the same thing as it does under the federal Constitution?
Well, not necessarily, because in Jones versus State, this court said that this court has found greater protection under the Delaware Constitution than the federal courts. It cited then to Bryan versus State with respect to giving more rights with the right to counsel. In that case, it dealt with...
But is this due process derived? And haven't we expressly said due process is coextensive?
This court has said that, but this court has also said that the defendant is entitled in certain circumstances to more rights, more protection with respect to the right to counsel under due process. So this court has...
Well, we said two different things. And we said generally due process is the same, and in the Delaware Constitution it's law of the land, so it's a synonym. But we've also pointed out in DeBerry and Hammond and other cases that due process under the Delaware Constitution can mean certain things.
Right.
So with regard to due process, we've recognized exceptions. With regard to the right to counsel, as you said, in Bryan v. State, we specifically held that the right to counsel under the Delaware Constitution is greater than the Sixth Amendment right to counsel because of the difference in the text.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And that's where I would argue that this court's power comes from in order to ensure that all defendants or prisoners, however you want to provide their context at that stage in the proceedings, get the same rights and that they all get their claims addressed with the same potential, the same insight by counsel for the courts to review and to ensure. Yeah.
I know this isn't in the record, but it may have some impact on your point of view about what we should or shouldn't do. But assume for the sake of argument that the Superior Court amends its Rule 61, and in that amendment it provides that there is no longer any discretion. The court doesn't review the petition on the merits and determines unilaterally that it's frivolous. And then only if it has some merit would they appoint counsel. Let's assume Rule 61 from this point forward, in order to preserve the procedural bar for purely financial reasons, despite our oath not to do anything for lucre, that's amended to provide counsel and the state funds counsel. Does this issue go away? Under those circumstances, will we have to address a constitutional right at all under these circumstances?
Now, if there's a rule that must be followed by the courts, then no, we wouldn't have to address whether there's a constitutional right unless they depart from it and then it needs to be addressed, or I would say that wouldn't be necessary.
That's what happened in Zabrowski, isn't it, where we dealt with procedural bars?
And
did not need to address the constitutional issue of successive
right.
61 counsel under the Delaware Constitution. I'd like to ask you about Ortiz and waiver and whether this issue is actually properly before us under the Delaware Constitution, because as I understand the record, the defendant made an application for counsel before the commissioner. Commissioner said no. There were objections to the commissioner's report filed with a Superior Court judge that did not include an application for appointment of counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Doesn't that, you can tell me whether or not there was a specific argument under the Delaware Constitution anywhere below. Does that not waive this Delaware Constitutional issue?
Your Honor, in the context of this situation, I would say no, because the whole reason we're here is the fact that the indigents in this situation don't have the benefit of counsel to make the proper arguments and assist them. When he makes a motion at the very beginning, it's not clear whether or not he knows that that's the type of issue that can be raised again on appeal, and I think this court can look at the record and see, you know, what rulings were made and make a determination as to whether that's something that needs to be corrected. And at the very least, even if we don't deal with the constitutional argument on appeal, the judge made a summary decision without making any analysis. And so even under Rule 61, she abused her discretion by not explaining the reason for denying counsel. And so I know this court has most recently in Monier George sent a case back for the defendant with counsel to be able to submit his claims or other claims that needed to be addressed to the court. And at the very least, with respect to Rule 61, I think it is appropriate for this court to deal with this situation.
And are you, just so I'm clear on your role here, are you appointed or did you enter an appearance?
I was asked by this court to represent Mr. Holmes. Unless the court has any further questions.
Does the record reflect whether Holmes presented his claim that his counsel inadequately investigated the relationship between Elder Smith and Holmes? Is that part of the basis for
the relationship between, I'm sorry?
Between Elder Smith and Holmes.
I don't see that as one of the claims below that I've listed by the Superior Court in her decision.
Okay.
Thank you.
And my final question is, in the back of my mind, whether the rule has changed consistent with the position you think we ought to take, though for an entirely different reason, for just a pragmatic reason,
or whether we were to adopt your proposed interpretation of the Delaware Constitution, is there a retroactivity issue in this case?
That's a good question. With respect to the rule, I don't think there would be. Under the Constitution, be perfectly honest with you, I did not investigate that. And I think that would be something worth my looking into if the court wanted further discussion on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the State. Martinez does not apply to this case at all. Martinez is limited to the federal courts and does not, in fact, require anything of a state court. It is entirely limited to the way the federal courts treat defaulted claims that come to them through habeas 2254.
Shouldn't we be concerned about keeping as well-established procedural bars as we can? So should we take action that conforms with Martinez's suggestion anyway in order to preserve the procedural bar?
Well, in this case particularly, there was no bar applied to ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims. And as a general rule in Delaware, any ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims, when presented in a first initial collateral review petition, are not barred. The only possible bar in a situation like that would be a time bar. Now, that can be, if you have a substantial claim, that can be reached through 61I5. So there is no bar to having an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, a substantial claim, ruled on the merits in an initial Rule 61 petition. The state routinely defends these in federal court without any problem whatsoever. And the bars generally apply to other claims and not to ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
Let me make sure I understand where you are on this. Let's assume there is no Rule 61 change. And let's assume we accept your view Martinez does not apply. No problem, why are we here, basically? If one of our Superior Court judges were to review a pro se Rule 61 petition based upon ineffective assistance of counsel and concluded that on its merits or on its face it was meritless, no counsel appointed, no counsel to be appointed because the initial review says the petition is meritless, is that a state court action that would bar review in the federal system or not?
Any holding that is on the merits, which would be a summary dismissal, as long as no procedural bar was applied, is reviewable under reasonable application in federal habeas.
So with or without counsel, they're going to review it, is what you're telling us?
Yes. As long as there's no procedural bar. If for example, say that a time bar was imposed and in an initial post-conviction motion, when that was reestablished in federal habeas, at that point in time, the state would say, well, that was barred, you know, an independent and adequate state rule. However, in order to avoid the cause and prejudice analysis, the state invariably does reach the merits in arguing why there was no prejudice for that bar, because the claim was insubstantial without merit, which would be the same place you would reach. So in terms of defending the state's rulings, it really wouldn't change. There's really no need to change. The bars are in place. It becomes when, for example, there would be no a claim raised for the first time in federal habeas, ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim that was not raised at all in the state court, and they went over to federal court. At that point in time, those are deemed exhausted but procedurally defaulted if they can't go back and get a ruling on the merits in state court. That's when it would.
Let's go with the Chief Justice's example, but change it. In the same scenario, pro se alleges ineffective assistance of counsel in the first Rule 61, Superior Court says denied. 3 years later, too late, we have the second Rule 61 motion, and the Superior Court says your ineffective assistance of counsel claim is time barred.
Correct.
What's going to happen in federal court?
Well, first of all, by finding that, the state court has found under I-5 that it was not a substantial claim. So when you get to federal court, in order to have Martinez apply, you have to establish that you had a substantial claim. By the way our rule is structured, the Delaware court must determine whether or not there was a substantial constitutional claim.
But I'm confused because I thought Martinez is talking about the idea that the claim itself could appear to be insubstantial because you don't have an attorney to put together a good Rule 61 petition.
But Martinez says in order to avoid the procedural bar, you have to establish it was a substantial claim. Hence, the Rule 61 as it stands now provides what Martinez is asking for. As long as the state court considers any constitutional claim like ineffective assistance of trial counsel under I-5, they've determined it's not a substantial claim.
Even though the petitioner doesn't have an attorney and therefore overlooks in the petition several important points with respect to trial counsel's inadequacy. So what the court is reviewing and saying is time barred and is barred as not raising a substantial issue, it's correct. There's no substantial issue there, but it's because there's no trial, there's no counsel.
Well, they can't say that. I see what you're saying, but that isn't what Martinez's holding says.
Well, what is the equity then that Martinez is addressing while avoiding an actual constitutional?
Martinez wants to make sure that ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims get a ruling on the merits and are not just barred. You raised it too late, it's a subsequent. Is a ruling on the merits.
But as part of their conceptualization of the concept, if that's redundant, of equitableness.
Yes.
Don't they talk about the fact that it's inequitable for the indigent to have to formulate his or her own petition, which because of lack of experience, ability to understand the law, lack of opportunity to investigate, they can't possibly bear that burden without the assistance of counsel, without getting a lower form of justice than the rich who can hire an attorney. Isn't that their concern?
They do express that in there.
But where do we go with that then?
Well, I'm sorry.
Well, wait a minute. On a rare occasion, I speak up. And finish my question, please.
So in order to fit that rationale with the holding, is your question, if I'm clear?
Yes.
I'm not sure where you fit that in. I think that if the state thinks that it would be best to appoint counsel in post-conviction, that it can be done through a rule, first of all. But the question then becomes, and the court has looked at this, at what procedures states used, and didn't seem to have a problem with states that appoint counsel once a petition is filed. Well, if you're saying that it's the equivalent of a direct appeal, where counsel automatically, without somebody having to docket an appeal, is required. In fact, you have a continuing obligation. Well, then why is it okay to wait for the pro se litigant to file a post-conviction motion and then decide to appoint counsel? Because if you need counsel that badly, you need to counsel to know you need to file a post-conviction motion, right? So That's why there's inherent problems in the rationale in Martinez. And if you go to you're going to automatically appoint immediately after direct appeal counsel in case you need to file a post-conviction motion, then I understand that that may be the most fair possible, but in the real world, it will be overwhelming if every conviction results.
Yeah, well, it's not my understanding that that's where any amendment to Rule 61 would go. My understanding is it would say once a Rule 61 post-conviction relief petition is filed, that triggers the automatic appointment of counsel rather than nothing more than a Superior Court judge's review of the petition to determine whether or not it's meritless. And if they determine it's meritless and currently under their discretion, they don't appoint counsel because it's civil and it's collateral. That's been the understanding. The question is, has Martinez changed that equation to where it makes good sound policy sense to say when some indigent person files a petition, that automatically triggers the appointment of counsel to help to review it, to give that indigent an equal chance with the rich to have a fair determination about whether that petition is meritless or not?
Well, as someone who defends these, it will be probably more work, actually, if counsel is appointed to defend, because then we will be defending ineffective assistance of counsel over ineffective assistance of counsel. I'm just in terms of...
We already have that dilemma.
And then do you get a subsequent post-conviction motion to challenge the ineffectiveness of the first post-conviction, and on it goes, and this is where they are in Connecticut, for example, where they are completely and utterly overwhelmed. It never ends.
Well,
and there is some
I'm not sure I follow. Why would it necessarily be the case if counsel needs to be appointed for your first post-conviction motion that you would then get counsel for a second motion that's alleging that your first post-conviction motion attorney was ineffective?
Because that was your first opportunity to raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel through counsel, and if it's a constitutional right to counsel in post-conviction, it's a constitutional right to effective counsel, and therefore you get to challenge that.
But if it were a rule and not a constitutional right,
that could be limited.
It would not have to go on in infinitum.
One would hope.
I don't want to read from Martinez at length, but in explaining the difference between a constitutional right and its equitable remedy, the majority opinion says what we've done here today permits the state to elect between appointing counsel to the initial review collateral proceedings or not asserting a procedural default in federal court. So that's how they characterize the choice for the states.
Correct. We don't use procedural default on ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims raised in initial post-conviction motions.
But does that language mean if we were to appoint by a change in the rule or by a decision based on the Delaware Constitution, if we were to require that counsel be appointed in the first instance of the initial Rule 61 so counsel can help the indigent review the basis for the complaint, if that language that Justice Holland just read was heard correctly by me and interpreted literally, it says that's how you preserve the bar. That's your option. You can
Correct.
Either forget about the bar applying by not appointing counsel, but if you appoint counsel, that preserves the bar. Is that not correct?
They also say that if that counsel was ineffective in post-conviction, that will that has to be litigated too, because you also lose the bar if that counsel was ineffective under Strickland and you have a substantial claim.
And that is the genesis for your revolving ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes.
What is your position on the claim under the Delaware Constitution? Is that properly before us today?
Well, no. In fact, the state is not quite sure how this is properly before the court at all, given that there was no claim on appeal related to the denial of the motion for appointment of counsel at all, much less under the Delaware Constitution. This was...
It's in the reply brief, at least.
It was not raised in the opening brief. It was not briefed, and we were directed to brief this. So in that sense, the state doesn't really quite see how it, but understands the court's interest. And as to the other question that came up about retroactivity, if it were constitutional, that would, in fact, create a retroactivity problem. As Gideon v. Wainwright was the only watershed rule that...
Yeah, when you say if it were constitutional, I mean if we were to broaden our article under our Constitution.
Correct.
Because we know it's not underpinned by the Constitution in Martinez.
Correct. But since we generally follow the Teague analysis, that would tend to be, in the state's view, a retroactivity problem.
But if there's a rule change...
If there's a rule change...
It would not retroactively apply to Holmes.
That is correct. Now, the other thing that a rule change would entail, and in the general balancing that the court does in these things to be considered, is the fact, one, whether this applies to pleas as well as trial convictions, and if we're asking counsel to make determinations as to ineffective assistance of trial counsel when they were not at trial, unlike your direct appeal counsel who's aware of the record below and can say, for example, I don't need to see the transcripts of jury selection because I was there, I know there was nothing going on that would raise a claim. That will not be true in post-conviction. Every hearing, everything that has been recorded, every transcript will be required for counsel to not be found ineffective for not at least reviewing the record as a whole.
And help us understand a question raised by the U.S. Supreme Court in other cases. We know that you have a right to the appointment of counsel in your direct appeal.
Correct.
But we won't let you challenge the ineffective assistance of your trial counsel in a direct appeal when you've got an attorney helping you. The first time you can do that is in Rule 61. If you had a right to the assistance of counsel in raising an issue that we said couldn't be raised, why don't you have the right to the assistance of counsel the first time you can raise it?
That's a good question. This court has not affirmatively shut down the ability, first of all, to raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims on direct appeal. In fact, this court has on occasion considered them if the record is sufficient to do so. But the problem usually is because it's the trial counsel who is raising those claims. And is not going to raise ineffective assistance of themselves. And hopefully they won't.
Although they often confess to it at hearings.
Yes.
So come back to my question, which you characterized as a good question. Help me with a good answer.
Well, first of all, I understand the position. I am just saying that if you want to make the change and appoint counsel in Rule 61 as a matter of equity, that can be done. The state thinks that the problems inherent in making it a Delaware constitutional position there would be a lot of problems because of retroactivity. And if you get to philosophically the idea that the trial really is the main event, all these other rights are to preserve and maintain a fair right to trial. That's what all of them are about. So the farther you get away from what actually happens at trial in fairness, the more remote the rights should be, the less.
I understand, but let's say hypothetically, however you want to characterize it, the defense counsel's performance was below standard, incompetent, ineffective. That's a fact. And we say, well, you just can't raise that in a direct appeal. When the first time you can raise it, why shouldn't you have a constitutional right to counsel?
Well, I just don't think it's necessary in that if there's a substantial claim, we already provide for that to be considered, and the court can appoint counsel. The state isn't saying that the counsel should never be appointed in Rule 61, but there's it's well known that the claims that you want to raise in post-conviction are ineffective assistance of trial counsel because that's your avenue past the procedural bars. And there are numerous, frankly, very frivolous claims being raised under the guise of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And to automatically provide a constitutional right to counsel to raise those types of claims and the burden it puts on the system when you can provide counsel for those cases where there is a potentially meritorious claim seems overly burdensome to the state and the taxpayers of Delaware.
And do you think that argument would have prevailed in Gideon versus Wainwright? It's pretty inconvenient to have trial counsel all the time. And expensive.
Well, I understand that, but we're not talking about at the main event now. We're a step removed. And the courts routinely do some sort of screening. It's not the federal court screens out about a quarter of the habeas petitions automatically without ever asking the state for a response. So there are situations where judicial economy can prevail and say, you know, that's entirely frivolous. Do every defendant who pleads guilty and signs a form that and says, I'm totally satisfied with my counsel, is now filing a claim that they were not properly counseled. I mean, this is how it goes. And you know, if I were in there, I'd be making that claim too. But if you're going to appoint counsel for every one of those and produce the transcripts and have hearings and then have another hearing to decide whether that counsel raised it properly, there will be no finality, and the state has an interest in finality. And in that light, like in Texas at least, for example, counsel who confess to their own ineffectiveness have repercussions. That doesn't appear to happen so much here. So that way you try to ensure that you do have effective representation. There's an incentive.
I thought I heard Ms. Walker argue that the Superior Court did not give a reason for refusing to appoint counsel, and that alone should be a basis for reversal. What's your position?
Well, the position there is that the Superior Court Commissioner specifically wrote, defendant has demonstrated the ability to effectively represent his concerns in his motion. The court found his arguments coherent but not compelling and found no need for appointment of counsel because the claims were not substantial.
All right. Well, here's another sentence from Martinez. A prisoner's inability to present an ineffective assistance claim is of particular concern because the right to effective assistance of trial counsel is a bedrock principle in this nation's justice system. So here, if a pro se person is close but doesn't raise a claim, can we really know there's no claim unless they had the assistance of counsel?
Well, under that theory, you would be appointing automatically immediately after direct appeal. Is that correct, John?
No, I'm just reading from Martinez. You know, what we're trying to do is figure out where the law should be, and we're just asking for your help. And I'm just reading, Martinez seems to suggest having the effective assistance of trial counsel doesn't seem to suggest, it states, having the effective assistance of trial counsel is a bedrock principle of the nation's justice system. And the corollary to that is, if you're going to challenge the effectiveness of your trial counsel, you need a lawyer to look at what they did.
That's correct, but they also found or decided not to find a federal constitutional right to counsel to do that.
Which perplexed the minority substantially.
Yes.
And confuses me. But I think I'm in good company.
I think so too, Your Honor. It's a very confusing case. Does the court have any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I guess one of the perplexing things about this is that the state's argument kind of puts the cart before the horse. What keeps getting missed here is that the argument is, well, it's not a substantial claim. The judge finds that, so then he's not entitled to counsel. In other words, if the trial court finds he wasn't able on his own to do anything with this claim, then an attorney can't do anything with it. That just doesn't make sense. So to rely on the court to review what it is that a pro se defendant has written in and of itself is a denial of the right to counsel, either under the state constitution or under the rules, which should be adopted by this court, that there should be an attorney to represent the individual from the beginning and deciding how to frame the issues. And the concern with respect...
What do you mean from the beginning? Because I've heard the state say there's a danger here of what I'm going to characterize as overkill, in that as soon as the direct appeal, let's assume hypothetically, is denied, there's going to be a Rule 61. We should immediately appoint counsel to investigate whether there's a basis for the Rule 61. That's never been in my head.
Right.
I thought any change in Rule 61 or any constitutional right claim you were making meant that when a petition triggered a review by a superior court judge, there would be counsel appointed.
Right.
But there wouldn't be counsel automatically appointed to file a Rule 61 or not based upon ineffective assistance of counsel.
No, I agree. What I meant was, let's say you had a defendant who lost on direct appeal, and he's made some type of a noise about wanting to file an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Perhaps the procedure should be something like he files like a notice of appeal type of a thing instead of an entire pleading with merits in it. And once he does that, it triggers the appointment of counsel, who then looks into the record on his behalf.
Don't hold your breath for that to happen.
No. The point is this, is that she was talking about the fact that then they would have to review transcripts that weren't reviewed before. Well, the same thing happens when attorneys on direct appeal are appointed. I wasn't at the trial. I have to order transcripts just as the person who would be doing the collateral review representation. And the other thing that the court could put in or make as part of, as it does with a direct review, is they don't have to file every frivolous claim. In fact, I think it would be more efficient for both the court and the state to have a filter where the counsel can go through and decide, well, this doesn't have merit, this claim that he's making.
Something like
Rule 26.
Rule 26 here?
Exactly right. So that would actually be more efficient for the courts and the state, I believe, and would also make sure that all the substantial claims are reviewed and not left up to the court to look at some document that a pro se defendant has written or his cellmate has written to decide whether or not there's substance to it and then decide to appoint counsel. And I think the retroactivity issue, I guess, would depend on whether the court determines it to be a procedural right versus a substantive right. And I don't think that whether it opens up floodgates, while it is a practical issue, I'm sure, should be the driving force behind finding a constitutional right where there should be one.
But we all agree if it's a simple change in Rule 61, it's not retroactive. But if we decide it's a constitutional right under the Delaware Constitution, that will trigger a retroactivity examination.
Right.
Going back God knows when.
Yeah. But there aren't very many out there, so I wouldn't worry about it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Thank you.